Hey guys, it's Sean, and I'm here to introduce you to a bonus episode of Real Blend because we got the opportunity to speak to Freddy Krueger himself, Mr. Robert Englund. And when you get the opportunity to speak to a horror icon like that, no matter the circumstances, you drop everything and you say yes. And that's why we're able to bring this interview to you. So the reason we got Robert Englund is because of his brief cameo on the first half of Stranger Things season 4. If you maybe are not caught up to speed on watching all of those episodes, he has an important scene, which he will discuss at length in this interview. His character is going to have significance, I believe, in the second half of the season, which is going to be dropping on July 1st, which is kind of why we wanted to get this interview out there. And, you know, fair warning to everybody going into this, you should be pretty caught up on Stranger Things before you listen to this interview, because we are going to talk in great detail about his character and the circumstances of his character and the ramifications of some of his actions. Also, you should just watch it because first half of Stranger Things season 4 was really, really good. And it continued to do a lot of the homages in tone, specifically to the Nightmare on Elm Street franchise, of which Robert Englund is a significant contributor. But also Englund's scene in particular is without question a direct reference to the Silence of the Lambs in the way that Stranger Things likes to reference things from our pop culture past. And Robert Englund gets into all of the things that sort of informed his performance as he tried to do his best Hannibal Lecter. I almost called him Freddy. I feel like I just want to call him Freddy. And there's 2 points in this interview where he will break into his Freddy voice. And it's just the greatest thing in the world. Like, you have to see Robert Englund doing Freddy Krueger. And so I'm going to throw right to the interview because it's time for you guys to listen to Robert Englund joining us on the Real Blend podcast to talk about his cameo in Stranger Things and several highlights over the course of his career.
I'm going to open up with this because obviously the Silence of the Lambs and Jonathan Demme, that entire opening, that entire shot down the actual corridor is clearly an homage to one of the greatest scenes in the history of cinema. And it made me think about iconic aspects in movies, and clearly with Freddy being an iconic character and Hannibal being an iconic character. And it made me think about if Freddy were to get into Hannibal's mind while he was sleeping, how Freddy would operate in Hannibal's mind, what he would do with Hannibal. And if those two were to somehow meet, have you thought about that at all? Those two iconic characters in cinema kind of meeting, and what Freddy would do in Hannibal's dreams or nightmares.
Well, you know, Lecter is one of my favorite screen villains. And I go all the way back to the Brian Cox interpretation. Yes. In Manhunter. Yeah, with William Peterson. And that's an extraordinarily haunting performance. And obviously the master, Anthony Hopkins. I recognized immediately when I got on the set, before I went into makeup and couldn't see any longer, that's what they were doing there. And that's the Duffer Brothers. You know, it's just layer upon layer upon layer of not only 80s nostalgia, but 80s production design and familiarity. And it begins to play with your subconscious when all of those things, you know, are manifesting at once, when there's a little bit of Silence of the Lambs, a little bit of Nightmare on Elm Street, a little bit of Amityville Horror, a little bit of Goonies, little bit of E.T., you know, E.T., all of these things are meshing and layering. And in essence, it's season 4 is also the kids are getting older. Our protagonists are getting older and exploring their sexuality and aging out of being kids and their cuteness. And so it's this loss of innocence, which I'm sure will be exploited in season 5, which is also the theme of Nightmare on Elm Street. But yeah, I recognize that. I don't know. I mean, if Hannibal Lecter fell asleep, you know, and it could be Brian or Anthony or Mads Mikkelsen. Was that the greatest show ever television? Yes. There were whole episodes without dialogue. But what they did there was they played with the concept of foodie, and the foodie being evil and being obsessive, which we know if you've ever gone out to dinner with one and watched them order and be fussy with the menu. Like a vegetarian, you know, that's embarrassing you in a barbecue restaurant. But I think it would be fun for Freddie to poison Hannibal, you know, somehow would be an interesting twist that he would get into Hannibal's head and convince Hannibal to go to a 3-star Michelin restaurant and actually have him gourmand himself to death, you know.
Yes.
This is amazing.
Yeah, yeah. Hannibal, try the blowfish.
That's great. You are honestly I would pay good money to watch this, Robert. I would please get this made at some point. That would be incredible.
Ready using his claw as chopsticks. You know?
Yes.
Robert, I'm curious when you're doing
wasabi.
More wasabi.
Great. When you're doing a scene like the one for Stranger Things that relies so heavily on flashback, but they still use your narration track. I'm just curious from a craft standpoint. Do you know at the time of filming the exact moments when you are going to be shown?
Well, obviously there's a script. And when I first saw it, I thought, well, great, I'll just learn the parts where I'm on camera. And so I called the studio, I had my agent call the studio and ask them. And the reply we got back was, they're going to film it all. They're going to film everything. So I learned it all. And because of COVID, I had plenty of time. And I'd also had a makeup test, you know, with the glorious Barry and Duncan over in my London hotel room. So I knew what I was going to look like. I had the added gift of not really being able to see wearing the makeup. So I didn't have to act blind. I actually couldn't see.
Oh, cool.
Plus I never had to do any of the cliches, you know, tapping a cane or reaching around, because he's been in the same space, the cell, for so long. He would know every square inch of it. He would have counted off every pace in every direction. He knows where his chair, his desk, his bed, where the bars are. He knows it instinctively by that time. So I didn't have to devote any energy to playing blind or acting blind. I went beyond that. And that was just a fact of his existence. And so I didn't have to devote energy to that. And I really could spend some time with the great writing. And there's a specific rhythm and even a kind of vernacular that Victor has. I assure you, you know, that I am, you know, still in hell. You know, he speaks a little bit formally sometimes. And whether that's because he's got nothing but Braille books to read in his cell, or for whatever reason, or whether he did in the 50s, you know, back then, what schools he went to after the war, we don't know, but that was given to me, and I'm English trained, so you really serve the writer and you try to find as much you can from the writing about your character and what other people say about you in the script, what other characters say about you. So my big concern was when they were cutting from me talking to Natalia and to Maya, to Robin and Nancy, when they would cut away, I was as the scene progressed, I got more and more emotional because I'm recalling this horrible, violent thing that happened that I wasn't able to save my family and those memories that are very uncomfortable for Victor. And so I wanted to make sure that emotionally my vocal performance would match. And I wanted to make sure I wasn't going to get called into Atlanta in 6 months to do all of that on a soundstage, to do on a dubbing stage, to do ADR over image, because you tend to get a little mellifluous and you tend to lower your voice a little bit. You get a little vain about your vocal work. You start sounding like a late night jazz disc jockey. S-E-X, yeah, I'm going to play a little John Coltrane for you. And I didn't want that to happen. And I have to do that. I mean, I'm a voice actor as well. And I have to use that kind of voice sometimes. So I didn't want to do that. I wanted it to still be Victor's emotional paragraph coming overlapping from the image in the cell to the image of the flashback. And I hadn't seen any of the flashback. And you don't want to be too dramatic because there's images in the flashback that are extraordinarily violent and emotional, and you don't need to gild the lily with your voice. Mm-hmm. But I didn't know when they were going to be cutting back to me, and they'd be cutting back to me, and I might be sobbing, or I might be having a real problem with a memory. So that was my concern. So we filmed it all. And then after we did that, I sat down with Sean in the cell for True Sound, and we did some of the lines again. So he'd have them clean if he needed them. But I was still emotionally in character. It was very, very clever of Sean to do that instead of bringing me back.
Sean Levy.
Yeah, we love him. Such a great director. Robert, we are very lucky in that we have a very loyal fan base that listens to our show through audio, through a podcast, but we also have a lot of people who tune into our YouTube channel whenever we have a video element such as this. So I have to address the fact that you are in a very cool room right now, and I've spoken to you a few times while you were in this room. I got to ask you, what is the coolest piece of memorabilia that you have in the room that you're in right now?
Well, I mean, I can't pick up the computer or I'll pull it out of the wall. I have a signed Christopher Lee original late 60s still black and white. He's bending over a woman with blood dripping into her cleavage, signed to me and my wife. I have a picture of Christopher Lee with my wife at the Brussels Film Festival. I have a Yusef Karsh of Karloff. Boris Karloff over there. I have a picture of me doing an old war horse, an old chestnut of a play called Journey's End, a World War I trench warfare play with, among other people, Andrew Stevens from The Fury, George Wendt from Cheers, Mr. Pip from Seinfeld. We're all there, you know, in the trenches. And in the middle of it all is Muhammad Ali. You know, we're all hanging out, came to see the show. I've got a Freddy Krueger drawn by The Simpsons here.
How many gloves do you have?
I've got gloves. I've got me on bones. I've got all the action figures. I've got a Freddy wall, and then I've got my 70s wall when I was playing. You know, I was the sidekick of the 70s, you know, Jeff Bridges and Arnold Schwarzenegger and Peter Strauss, Henry Fonda, you know, Gregory Harrison, Dennis Christopher. I was always the best friend, the pal, the buddy. But in this generation, or in that generation and now, the sidekicks don't age as well. And just by pure accident, I got into science fiction and then into horror. And that's extended my career, I think. I owe the genre for because now I get to play the old priest, the old scientist, the old doctor, the old poacher. I tell the backstory, just like Victor Creel tells a lot of backstory. And in fact, I just did that on a film. I was reunited with Dwight Little, who directed me in my Phantom of the Opera. Bill Nighy and Jill Sholin, Cutting Class, and the stepfather, Jill. Wonderful movies. I think she had Keanu Reeves and Brad Pitt as back-to-back leading men, you know, which is pretty extraordinary.
It's not too bad.
Jill's wonderful, and she really does sing. But Dwight Little's wonderful, an old friend, and we just did a great little low-budget horror movie. We got Danielle Harris, among others, in it. But it's called Natty, as in Natalia, or Natalie, Natty Knox. And it's about late 60s scream queen.
Yes.
Comes back to haunt her hometown. And I do that thing and I tell the whole story, you know. So I'm doing that a lot. And I wouldn't be getting these parts, you know, had I not said yes to Wes Craven back in 1984.
Wow.
Very true.
You know, Robert, we've been doing this show for years. I've been doing this job I'm in now for about 15 years, and I've never, ever had the chance to speak with you. And growing up, like, I will never forget seeing Freddy vs. Jason in theaters and just like, but just that what that character has meant to my life in terms of like going over to my friend's house and like sneaking and watching those R-rated movies against my parents saying that they wouldn't want me to watch that stuff. So I go to a friend's house to watch it. And this is a question I've always wanted to ask you.
That's actually, parenthetically, what you just said is actually true of Adam Goldberg, who produces the Goldbergs. That's why I did that show. That actually happened to me. I had to go to the next door neighbors to watch. Yeah.
Yeah. That's what I had to do.
I was usually the next door neighbors that my friends came over and watched it at my house.
The cool neighbor, the cool stepfather. Yeah.
Yeah. And so this is it might be a cliche question, but I've always wanted to ask you this. Is there a specific nightmare that you have had recurring in your life? I mean, like, what is a Robert Englund nightmare like? I mean, considering what you've done for cinema and what that character means to dreaming and nightmares. And did your nightmares or dreams shift at all from before you played Freddy and after? Like, I'm just wondering how subconsciously that affected you.
They really didn't shift, but I'll tell you that I've had two really long running nightmares. One began as a child. There was actually two I had as a child. It was a very famous cult film called The 5,000 Fingers of Dr. T. And it's about it's Tommy Redding, the original star of Lassie, the boy, and Hans Conried, the voice of the mirror in Disney's Snow White. And it's about, you know, the nightmare of piano lessons. And Salvador Dali did the production design. And there's a moment in it when the boy falls, he spirals in this Salvador Dali-esque vortex onto a piano because he doesn't want to, he's done with these piano lessons. It's too much pressure. And I saw that in the afternoon, staying home from school with a fever. And I dreamt that falling onto the piano for years. Simultaneously, in the 1950s, when I was a child, the Korean War, along with World War II in movies, but the Korean War was still happening and on the 6 o'clock news and was kind of scary, you know, and it was North Korean and Chinese soldiers in those hats with the flaps that cover your ears, little red star here, you know, the communist star, Pork Chop Hill, you know, that the Korean War thing and not at all done benignly and anti-war as MASH, but the real cruel Cold War that it was. And I had a girlfriend in the sixth grade. So this is my second nightmare, recurring nightmare. And she was beautiful. And I wrote about this a little bit in my book, but I'm trying to save her from hordes of North Korean Chinese soldiers coming across, communist soldiers with their long coats on and those flapped hats. And they're coming onto my playground and I'm cornered on the handball court. And I'm dramatically laying in her lap in the sixth grade and my hormones are raging, my pre-adolescent hormones. And there's blood coming out of the corner of my mouth and she cradles me, you know, as I fight off, you know, all of these soldiers coming. And I had that into my 20s. I had that dream. And now the recurring nightmare I have is I'm backstage for Merchant of Venice, one of the Shakespearean productions I did. And I start the show with the Merchant of Venice, which is not Shylock like everybody thinks, but Antonio, who goes after Shylock, and Shylock wants his pound of flesh from him. And it's the opening of the play. And in sooth, I know not why I am so sad. And I'm one of the two buddies, the two decadent young Italian merchants that hangs out with him. And I had this big line about it, you know. And my nightmare is, it's the actor's nightmare. I don't know my lines, but I've hidden a script backstage and I can pull it out behind that 1x3 piece of pine, you know, and canvas and just look at it really quick. And then I'll be all right. I'll be okay. And I can enter into the spotlight and they're waiting. I hear my cue and I'm waiting and I can't find the script I've hidden. I can't find it anywhere. And my heart starts beating and I start to sweat and I'm panicking and I wake up and I have that dream probably once a week to the actor's night and not knowing your lines, you know.
Wow. I'm sure you're not alone in the acting community.
Well, we all have it, but it's a stress dream depending upon whatever your business or work is. Yours, I'm sure with you guys sometimes it's about deadline.
Yeah. Interviews. Yeah. I have dreams about interviews.
Often. Yeah. Yes. Robert, let's break a little bit of news. Clearly, Victor's not going to get one scene in this season. Are we seeing you back when the show returns?
I don't know. You know, what I realized is because I just finished watching the whole entire season 4. And I obviously, without giving out a lot of spoiler alerts, I see where they're going and we see what's manifesting itself with Henry, my son. And we've learned the truth of that. But there's a moment when Natalia, when Nancy is in the sort of red, upside down underworld, Salvador Dali, floating things and stalactites and stalagmites and bits and pieces of Hawkins, you know, there, you know, and the roots growing everywhere. And there's a voiceover by Vecna. There's a voiceover there, and he talks about me. Old Victor. Oh, I haven't seen old Victor in a while.
Right.
That beautiful voice. I don't know who's doing that voiceover. It sounds a little bit like Andrew Deboff, but I'm not sure who it is doing the voice. And it's this beautiful voiceover work. And you can hear him breathing and stuff. And he says, well, maybe, he goes, I've been so, so busy, but maybe I should revisit him or something. So I don't know what that means. I don't know if that's just the writing reaffirming to the audience the relationship between the two, you know, Henry, Victor Vecna, or if it's means that he's got to come back and kill me, you know, or he wants to relish my death because as a father, I let him down, you know, and that I had been responsible, and I'm a hypocrite, like, you know, like he says to 11, you know, I'm a hypocrite, you know, and I was responsible for a baby's death during World War II and all of that, you know, bougie suburban dad, you know, and I, you know,
right.
So there, that may, could be any of those reasons, you know, but you know, Victor, what's Victor? What is the name Victor? What is the drop down basic horror collective consciousness of the name Victor Frankenstein?
Yes, yep. Very true.
And who is Victor Frankenstein? What did he do? He gave birth to what? A monster. A monster. Because Frankenstein is the scientist, not the monster. And I'm Victor Creel, and I gave birth to a monster. So what does that say about my evil seed? You know, I mean, I don't
some
know
good writing
that means. I mean, there's a whole lot of stuff going on there.
Yeah, the and also some interesting, value. Yeah, for people who know the story behind Freddy's Dead, also some interesting parallels.
Also, is Henry, was he, am I in denial? Was I blind? Was I blind to his evil when we moved to that house? They say my wife suspected it. Did I not know? Did I not want to know? Am I innocent of that? Or did he bring the evil to that house, or was it already there waiting in Hawkins? And was he an open vessel for it? And why was he an open vessel for it? What was in him that allowed the evil to get into him? Or was he already tainted? Was he already a tainted child? There's that child of him when he walks in the door, and that's a strange kid. Yeah, I mean, yeah. He makes the Adams family look healthy.
Mr. England, unfortunately, we have to cut you loose there.
All right. We had so many questions.
Yeah, this was really such a pleasure for us. We're all just massive fans. So seriously, thank you for joining us on Real Blend. We really appreciate it. Hopefully you had a great time.
Thank you.
We want to thank Robert Englund for joining us on the show. And I want to point out how cool it is that, you know, a lot of times when actors are associated with the same character and they have to talk about that character over and over again, it can get tiresome. And Robert Englund absolutely has plenty of other things in his career that he can go on at length about. And as he pointed out multiple times, he's a Shakespearean trained actor. He's extremely gifted and has stayed extremely busy over the course of his lengthy career. But it's always fun to see when they don't mind spending time with the character that really put them on the map and hearing him talk about Freddy. And show how much love he has and respect he has for that character is really great, is really special. And we're all just thrilled that he was able to join us and talk about his role on Stranger Things, of which I really hope that he has more to do before season 4 comes to a close with the last two episodes. OK, so we are dropping this as a bonus episode. We are going to have a full episode coming up where we're going to be doing another tier list. We're going to be doing some Obi-Wan spoilers and still playing hashtag Summer Movie Blend. So make sure you keep it here on the Real Blend channel. I hope everybody enjoyed the Tom Hanks episode. Please let us know in the comments down below whether you guys got a chance to watch that. And we're just rolling through the summer season. We got a lot of big things coming up. So keep it right here on Real Blend by hitting subscribe, turning on your notifications, and then coming on back to the channel every time we drop a new video.
Welcome to another round of Drawing Board or Miro Board. Today, we talk brainstorms with UX designer Brian. Let's go. First question. You thought you'd see everyone's idea in the team brainstorm, but you've got a grand total of one. Drawing Board or Miro Board?
Drawing Board, right? Because in Miro, the team can add ideas now or later. And with Privacy Mode, we can keep them anonymous until they're good to share.
Correct. Next, you need the best way to explain your idea, but all you have is a few sticky notes. Drawing Board or Miro Board?
Drawing Board, because, you know, in Miro, I could record videos, add text, images, links, and digital sticky notes, of course. Present my thoughts the way I want.
Right again! Now, you're looking for a past idea you thought was just genius. Only you could find... Oh, there it is. Drawing Board or...
Miro. All our finished and unfinished work lives in one place.
And he's won.
Join over 60 million people getting ideas noticed in Miro Brainstorms. Get your first three boards for free at Miro.com. That's M-I-R-O.com.